I'm your host, Michael Callahan, and wherever you might be now, this is Where We Go Next. And Nick Troiano is the founding executive director of Unite America, a philanthropic venture fund that invests in nonpartisan election reform to foster a more representative and functional government. Since 2019, Unite America has invested over $50 million to help win three major statewide ballot initiatives and over a dozen state legislative and municipal policy victories. In 2014, he ran for the U.S. House of Representatives in Pennsylvania's 10th District and was both the youngest candidate of the cycle and the most competitive independent congressional candidate nationally in over two decades. His new book, The Primary Solution, which came out last Tuesday, offers voters across the political spectrum a realistic roadmap to a more representative and functional democracy. Nick, thanks so much for joining us today.
Wonderful to be with you, Michael.
A recurring topic with guests of this show, whether it's with Greg Lukianoff, president of FIRE, or Monica Guzman, senior fellow at Braver Angels, is that political extremism is tearing this country apart from the inside. Our elected representatives, at least the ones that seem to dominate our news cycle, are less and less likely to compromise. In the 1960s, a time of great and often tumultuous social change, it wasn't uncommon for there to be conservative Democrats or liberal Republicans in the House and Senate, but 60 years later, that sounds like a fantasy. To quote from the opening of The Primary Solution, quote, "The main idea of this book is that partisan primaries are not merely one problem among a long list of problems with our political system. They are, pun intended, the primary problem in our politics today," end quote. Now, one, I love a good pun, and two, that's quite the assertion, Nick. So why is it true?
Well, Michael, I didn't begin my journey in election reform a decade ago believing this, but have come to hold this conviction over time based on real-world experience of both running for office and trying to advance systemic fixes to this underlying systemic problem of polarization. And what I've come to appreciate is that partisan primaries play a disproportionate role in why our system is so dysfunctional and divided today. And that's because, as you have mentioned, things have radically changed over the last 50 years or so. Today, the main dynamic in our politics is that most of our congressional seats are considered safe for one party or another. And it's not just because of partisan gerrymandering, but also because of our own geographic sorting, conservatives living in more rural areas, progressives in more urban. And so what that means is for 83% of our U.S. House seats, those elections are not decided in the November election when most people vote. They're actually decided in the dominant party's primary when they nominate a candidate months earlier. And the challenge there is that very few people turn out in those elections. Millions of independent voters are disenfranchised. And in order to get through those elections, candidates have to go to the far left or far right to pander to the base of their party. And so the leaders that wind up getting elected are not only unrepresentative of their districts, they are also incentivized to continue to pander to the far fringes rather than work together to solve problems, as most of us would hope they would do, just to get reelected. And that's a dysfunction in our politics today that we're looking to solve by addressing this challenge of partisan primaries.
Looking at a recent Pew Research poll, it's not just our elected officials who have become more politically extreme. All Americans have. Recent Pew Research data shows that Republicans and Democrats are further apart politically today than they were 30 years ago in 1994. But those who identify as politically engaged are even more polarized than the general public. But the politically engaged are the very ones who are much more likely to participate in primaries because, I think you can see where I'm going with this, they're the most politically engaged among us. So how will abolishing partisan primaries decrease extremist candidates if the voters with the most extreme politics, regardless of political affiliation, are the most likely to participate in primaries in the first place?
The simple answer is that we should move the election of consequence, meaning the election that effectively decides the outcome, from the primary to the general election when most people do vote. So rather than the primaries deciding the outcome, the primaries serve their purpose of winnowing the number of candidates that everyone else chooses from by the time the November election rolls around. What I should have mentioned in my prior response is that it was just 8% of Americans that cast ballots in those 83% of districts that wound up electing the leaders to go to Congress. So today we have 8% of Americans electing 83% of our leaders. If we move the election of consequence to the November election, we will increase the number of voters that ultimately are responsible for the election of our officials, and therefore the number of Americans that our government will be responsive to. And so the essential reform that we're pursuing is to replace the party primaries, the red ballot and the blue ballot, with nonpartisan primaries, which is a red, white, and blue ballot, as I describe it, where all the candidates are listed, regardless of party affiliation. Everyone gets to participate, and the top finishers, whether that's the top two finishers or the top four finishers in different systems, go to the general election. And in the general election, it's whoever wins a majority of votes that gets elected. That will have a radically profound impact on our politics, because from day one, candidates will be campaigning to the entire electorate, not just to the base of their party. And every voter will get a ballot that really counts.
To go to your 8% of the electorate, elect 83% of our sitting House representatives, or 359 seats out of 435, which is just an insane stat, there's nothing actively preventing any American of voting age from registering for one party or another today, right? Now, we can argue that having a closed primaries where someone has to identify as either Republican or Democrat is anti-democratic, and I am sympathetic and agree with that view. But if we were just steelmanning it for a second in terms of 8% electing 83%, nothing's preventing them from registering and participating in primaries today. So what do we say to someone who looks at this 8% stat and says, reform isn't the problem, laziness is?
I don't think it's lazy if you don't want to be coerced into joining a private organization in order to have a right to vote. And so there are about 24 million independent voters, for example, that by law cannot participate in the party's primary that their own taxpayer dollars are funding. That's wrong, especially when you consider that among those, you have a majority of young people, millennials and Gen Z, and close to half of veterans that identify as independents. And so we're telling the future of our country and those who fought for our country that they don't get to have a say in who their leaders are. I think that's deeply un-American, not lazy. That's why I think it's great that more states are changing these rules to open their primaries so that every eligible voter can vote for any candidate, regardless of party affiliation, in every election. Over 70% of Democrats, Republicans, and independents support that principle. But that principle is not the case in about 45 states that use party primaries.
There's something that you hammer home repeatedly in the primary solution, which is the idea that we are prisoners to our past, so to speak. There's this quote that you have from John Adams, founding father and second president of the United States. He wrote in 1780, quote, "There is nothing which I dread so much as a division of the republic into two great parties, each arranged under its leader and concerting measures in opposition to each other. This, in my humble apprehension, is to be dreaded as the greatest political evil under our Constitution," end quote. But even today, we are basically pantomiming traditions of the past, which no longer make sense today. You go through the steps of what going to an election in 1824, 200 years ago, would look like. And you say, quote, "The election is scheduled on a Tuesday to ensure that you won't have to travel on the Sabbath and that you'll be back home by Wednesday," which, of course, is market day, end quote. Now, you could probably go to the average person today and ask them what market day is, and they'll have absolutely no idea what you're talking about. And yet, we still hold elections on Tuesdays as if this is a primarily agriculture-driven rural society. Why do we seem to have so much trouble, I suppose, reforming our system to update it so it's not 200 years old?
It's a great question. For a lot of our history, we haven't had trouble. As I point out in the book, party primaries were not handed down to us by our founders, in part because they didn't contemplate. In fact, they feared parties to begin with. So once parties rose, then we had to figure out how do they nominate their candidates. And originally, that was done through privately organized caucuses and conventions until voters rightly demanded that they ought to have a direct say, not just the party bosses, in who gets nominated. And so in the early 1900s rose the system of direct primaries. Same thing happened with, of course, who gets to vote. Women winning the right to vote, all citizens over the age of 18, regardless of race, for example. The fact that we directly elect our Senate, that didn't used to be the case. The state legislatures did that. So most of American history is a tradition of updating our democracy to meet the challenges of our times and the demands of the citizenry. We need to remember that history because the system is failing us today. 69% of Democrats and Republicans agree democracy is at risk of collapse right now. We shouldn't just be focused on who we elect. We should be focused on how we're electing, because it's our system of elections that determine the incentives that our elected officials have and how they behave. And we have the tools to fix it. As I always want to remind people, the agency we have, especially when it comes to these reforms, we're not talking about amending the Constitution or passing a law through Congress. Every state has the ability to amend the rules of their elections, either through the legislatures or through a process we invented a century ago, ballot initiatives, where you can go around the legislatures and citizens can directly vote up or down a law. And that's how reform has made progress in the past, and that's how it is making progress as we speak.
One of the reforms that you propose is a national primary day. Can you explain how a national primary day would help lessen extremism in the primary process?
To your point earlier about one way to mitigate the problem of partisan primaries is for more people to participate in them, even the folks that are already registered with the parties that hold these primaries. I do think that would be a step forward. It's not the ultimate solution, but it will make those primary electorates more representative than they are today. So one way that we can encourage turnout, if you're looking at, say, state and congressional primaries, for example, is to have all the primaries in all 50 states actually hold their primary on the same day. Today, I believe there's something like 16 or 17 different days that states will hold primary elections for congressional or state office. And so they don't get as much attention. But if the whole country were to be voting on a particular day, I think that will raise the salience of how important these elections are. Because like I said, in most places, those are the only elections that actually matter. The presidential primary system is sort of its own beast in the way that reforms can potentially help solve for it. But as you reference, having a condensed window for some early states, maybe even a rotating set of states to do some vetting of candidates leading to a day in which all states would vote, would not only help increase turnout, but would actually make most voters' ballots matter. Consider this 2024 presidential election playing out right now. Fewer than 1% of voters nationally have cast ballots, yet we're already talking about presumptive nominees. So a national primary day will also ensure that everyone gets to weigh in before the parties really decide who their standard bearers are in running for president.
I think when someone hears about national primary day, in which all the primaries are held on a single day, their initial reaction might be, what if we make the wrong choice? That there is something to figuring out state by state who we should send to the general election. Because as you note in the book, if we do all of the elections on a single day, all the primaries on a single day, and then a scandal comes out that is potentially disastrous to that candidate, we're kind of stuck with them for the general election. So how do we balance the vetting process that is currently possible with our much longer primary season with what I think you correctly argue is a more pro-democratic approach for a national primary day?
You're specifically referring to presidential primaries that happen every 4 years. And there is no perfect system. I do think striking the right balance between a rotating set of early states and a day in which others follow is a way of ensuring that there is a period of some vetting. But the other thing is, we should shrink the total timeline. We're unique in the world of having a presidential election that kicks off oftentimes the year prior to the election year, goes through the summer conventions. That's a process that I don't think serves voters very well. It increases the cost of our elections, reduces who might even be a viable candidate. So we can continue to reimagine the way that we pick our president. The other ideas that I talk about in the book of improving this process is, which I think is even more important than the primary day, is ending party caucuses. If we want people to participate, we shouldn't expect them to show up between a particular time in the evening and cast their votes publicly. It's a pretty high barrier of entry for voters. We should also look at using instant runoffs in the presidential primary process so that voters have a more nuanced way of expressing their preferences rather than just picking one candidate when they can rank them. It also prevents votes from being wasted if candidates drop out by the time that voters had already cast their ballots. So those are some of the other ideas that I think we can use to pick a president. And especially in a year like 2024, when both major parties are set to nominate candidates that are broadly unpalatable to 2/3 of the electorate, having an instant runoff in the general election, I think, can also level the playing field for independent or third-party candidates that right now either voters are afraid to vote for fear of spoiling the election, or that might actually cause a pretty severe unintended consequence for democracy. So these are some of the other ideas I think we should embrace as we think about who should be the leader of the free world.
Ranked choice voting is such a good idea. I mean, it's so good that when you learn about it, you're like, why don't we use this? Talk to us a bit about the 2020 ballot initiative in Alaska that Unite America helped pass in that state.
Alaska passed an initiative that we refer to as sort of Final Four voting. And the reason why is it has two components to the reform. It has a top four nonpartisan primary where there's a single all-candidate ballot. People can choose between D's, R's, or I's. You select your favorite. And the top four finishers go to the general election where there's an instant runoff using a ranked choice ballot. And what that means is essentially if there's four candidates on your ballot, you can vote the old way and simply select your favorite, or you can rank them 1, 2, 3. And the advantage of this is if no one of those four candidates earns an outright majority of first place votes, instead of calling voters back and holding another election between, say, the top two finishers in a traditional runoff, you instead eliminate the candidate with the least support and redistribute those voters' ballots to their second preference. And that process repeats until someone does earn a majority. That's why it's called an instant runoff. And this system has other advantages, including leveling the playing field for third-party candidates and even incentivizing candidates to build broader coalitions. Because if voters aren't going to rank you first, perhaps they'll rank you second. And it diminishes a bit of the zero-sum negativity that's in our politics. So it's really the combination of the nonpartisan primary and the instant runoff that makes Alaska such a powerful system. And we saw that when it was first used in 2022. We saw Democrats and Republicans win under the system, didn't advantage either party. But most importantly, there was something like a 60% increase in the number of voters who cast ballots in competitive elections where their vote actually made a difference. It wasn't just decided by party affiliation alone. So this system gives much more power to the voters to elect people who can truly represent them. And that's a game changer in a political system right now in which people feel awfully disaffected for good reason.
It sounds like an increase in political engagement is directly tied to a decrease in political pessimism.
I would say increase in political engagement within the context of a system that can translate that participation into representation.
Yes.
If you said, hey, would you rather see 100% voter turnout or put in some reforms that can make the people who do participate, their votes actually matter, I would choose the latter because it's possible you can have a very participatory system that isn't very representative, or you can have a system that may not be 100% participatory, but is actually much more representative of the electorate. And it's that latter system that I think we should be focused on trying to foster in our country.
Just a 60% increase in voter turnout as a result of Alaska's reforms just makes me think that if you believe that your vote is really going to matter, because I think to your point earlier, Nick, I think a lot of people, honestly, myself included, if we just look at the current presidential selections, I think that a lot of people become disenchanted with the entire process because they feel that all of their choices are bad. And I think with something like ranked choice voting, if it's like, okay, I know that I might prefer this person, but my second best option is this person and my third best option is this person, and that any one of these people, even if they're my second choice, could potentially be elected. I wouldn't be that opposed to them winning. It just seems to me, whether it's in Alaska or Maine or again, hopefully Nevada, it seems like if people feel like they have real choice, then they have real skin in the game and they become engaged.
I think that's probably correct. And I'd like to offer a bit of a nuanced perspective on what you shared, which is that first, we did not see a 60% increase in turnout in the number of voters that are actually participated. What we saw was a 60% increase in the number of ballots that were cast in elections in which those ballots actually made a difference in electing someone in a contest that wasn't just decided by party affiliation. So let's give an example. If there's a solidly blue district and I'm a Republican voting in the general election, sure, I have participated. But that election is effectively over, regardless of how I cast my support for the, say, Republican candidate in this red district. Because of the party affiliation and the way the district is made up, the Democrats are always going to win in that district. Where that changes is now I'm voting in that blue district, and there's four candidates on the general election ballot. There may be a Republican, independent, and maybe two Democrats. I can now have a fuller expression of my vote because whereas I may still rank the Republican first, I get to decide ultimately which of the two Democrats that are running that are most likely to win ultimately get elected. which of those candidates will be a better representative of the district. My vote went from not being very meaningful to being very meaningful. And that's what I was referring to in sort of the 60% increase, which gets at why is that the case? And it's not just the function of ranking the candidates that allows that. It is inherently the fact that there are now four candidates in the general election. I have more choice. There's more competition. It's not just decided in a binary red-blue election. And so the power of this system comes predominantly from the fact that we have replaced the party primaries, not just from the fact that we can rank them, which is why I think the Alaska system that has both components is much more powerful than the Maine system, in which it only has the ranked choice ballot in the general election, but a traditional party primary. I know that's quite in the weeds for an audience that might not be experts in election reform, but oftentimes, I feel like the broad label of ranked choice voting is used too loosely in describing the differences in these systems.
Got it. So for ranked choice voting to be at its most effective, a nonpartisan primary at the beginning is paramount.
Yes, that's a great way of saying it. And it's possible to have a nonpartisan primary without ranked choice voting. There's a couple states that have, for example, a top two system, Nebraska, Louisiana, effectively California and Washington. This is when there is a single ballot, all candidates are running, and the top two finishers go to the general election. That could be a D and an R, or in a solidly red district where a Republican will always win, two Rs, or vice versa, in a blue district, two Ds. And because there are only two candidates, you don't need an instant runoff to decide a majority winner. So there are different permutations of this system. The real power is replacing the traditional partisan primaries with a nonpartisan primary because it makes true the principle that every eligible voter can vote for any candidate, regardless of party, in every election.
And a nonpartisan primary makes independent candidates that much more viable.
Yes, as you noted, I ran as an independent back in 2014 for Congress. And while I gathered enough signatures to get my name on the general election ballot, the fact that I did not participate in a primary meant that no one paid attention really to my candidacy until November. That was the first problem. I wasn't able to participate in a primary. And then secondly, in that three-way contest, and this is where I think ranked choice voting has a real benefit, people would say, I like you, Nick, but I can't vote for you because that will take away a vote for my second preferred candidate and might cause the election of my least preferred candidate. This new system does level the playing field for candidates outside the two major parties. It is stunning to me that there are more independents than there are Democrats or Republicans in our country, but in our Congress, all 435 members are Democrats or Republicans. And it's by virtue of an election system that has locked out effectively any kind of competition because of our current process for voting.
Yeah, currently, especially in presidential elections, any politician who's not part of the two major parties is often considered a spoiler. And so people won't vote for, let's say, the Green Party or the Libertarian Party or an independent candidate because in their mind, and understandably so, because history has bore this out repeatedly, they think, if I vote for this person, they're not going to get elected anyway, so I shouldn't vote for them because they have no chance. And it becomes this self-fulfilling cycle in which the only people who can ever get elected are Democrats or Republicans, because in the minds of the voters, any other candidate is a waste of a vote.
That's exactly right. And it ultimately leads to a Congress that doesn't represent a majority of Americans and doesn't do what a majority of Americans want. You know, in the book, I cite some research of dozens of policies where you can get majority or even supermajority support from voters across the spectrum, but our Congress still doesn't act. And so, although politics has become much more divided, the greatest tragedy in our politics today isn't that we the people can't find agreement, it's that our leaders can't even when we do. And when if we have a Congress that was more representative of the country, I do believe that we would have a much better chance at solving a lot of the seemingly intractable problems on immigration, on inflation, on our budget, a climate, and so on. That's the real cost of our political dysfunction today, is these problems are not just being left unsolved, they're compounding and getting worse with time. So these election reforms, I feel, are not a nice to have. They're a must do in order to have a representative democracy that can not only address the common problems we face, but can actually sustain over the long term. Because our political division is becoming such an issue where our institutions themselves are under threat, as we saw after the 2020 election and again this year.
Yeah, there's this phrase by theorist Anthony Stafford Beer. The purpose of a system is what it does. In your words, our political system, quote, rewards politicians who pander to their party's base with re-election while hoping they will come to Congress and work together to get things done, end quote. And it just creates this relentless cycle where, as you said, reform becomes impossible because elected officials pander to the most extreme, most engaged voters who want the least amount of compromise. And so then it almost creates this doom loop where the general voter, who is much, much more moderate by every single measure, looks at their elected officials voting in extreme ways, refusing to compromise, and then becoming more and more politically disengaged as they become more and more disenchanted with a system that never works for them.
That's right. Warren Buffett's business partner, Charles Munger, had a great quote that essentially said, "Show me the incentives and I'll tell you the outcome." We should not be surprised by the outcomes that we are seeing today once you understand what the incentives are. We are rewarding division and dysfunction. We are punishing compromise and problem solving. And so it is no surprise we have a Congress that has a 20% approval rating, but a 90% reelection rate. We don't like what they're doing, but we continue to reward it. It's irrational, and it's not going to change until we fix the system. Another hypothetical is if you gave me the option and said, Nick, would you rather replace all 535 members of Congress today, or would you rather change the method by which the current folks are elected? Again, I would choose the latter. It will make a bigger difference in getting a better Congress if we can impact the way that our leaders are chosen. It's not just a people problem. It is a systems problem.
If you were king for a day, so to speak, or had a magic wand, you could literally replace all 535 elected officials with really fantastic elected officials who would agree to compromise. But within 2 years or 6 years, depending on if they're in the House or the Senate, they are going to be replaced with extreme candidates because the system itself incentivizes it.
Exactly.
It seems like the only way out of this problem then is ballot initiatives, because what incentive do currently elected officials have to reform a system that works for them into a system that doesn't?
I would say the ballot pathway is perhaps easier, although the ballot initiative process itself is becoming under attack for this very reason in many states. However, in about half the states that don't have a ballot initiative, I would make the argument that there are a lot of good people serving in office that understand how constrained they are because of this current system and would look forward to the day where they are liberated from it in order to actually do what they ran and got elected to do. And it's even in the self-interest of the parties themselves. I mean, I think the political parties, as they were traditionally understood, have lost control of their nominating processes to the political activists, to the special interests, and they wind up nominating candidates far outside the mainstream of the electorate, which means that they're uncompetitive and they lose. You know, if you're the Republican Party in the last midterm elections, they nominated 5 MAGA-affiliated candidates that turned off independent voters, and they lost all 5 seats and they lost control of the Senate. Majority Leader McConnell referred to it as candidate quality. Candidate quality is a function of the primary problem. Actually, I think even in states without the ballot process, to the extent that the incumbent legislators would like to do what they ran to do, and the parties would actually like to become competitive organizations again to win elections, there is a pathway for these reforms there as well.
What I love so much about your book is that it's part deep dive history lesson, part explainer breakdown, part solution-oriented how-to guide that can guide the average person to become more politically engaged and help reform our systems. You talk about how in the 1800s, we had these corrupt bigwig party leaders who had complete control over the people who would be put up to the average voter to become elected, right? The people who would be on the ballot to be elected were hand chosen by these corrupt party leaders so that they would get their guy in. So you really had like the illusion of choice as a voter, but you didn't really have much choice at all, which is how primaries initially came to be. But it seems like we have the exact opposite problem now. Now both parties, whether Democrat or Republican, to go back to the Mitch McConnell quote you had, you talk to a lot of these Republicans behind the scenes, for instance, elected officials, and they do not want Trump. It does say something. And the same thing is happening with Biden, right? There are people behind the scenes who are concerned about Biden running again. But it's just interesting to see that contrast between 200 years ago and today, where 200 years ago, you had party officials who had all the say in who would run for their party. And now you have party officials who are watching from the sidelines as candidates are elected who they don't want.
Yes. My shorthand of describing this is the party bosses were replaced by the party bases. In no system did an actual representative electorate get to have the power of nominating. And so this is why I describe it as bad for the voters, bad for the parties, and bad for our country in terms of these outcomes. The current system only serves the fringes and the special interests, period. It does not serve the rest of us, whether you are in a political party or not. And that's why I think this experiment with the direct primary was a step forward from the sort of corruption of the party machine. But this experiment is not yet done. We can continue to improve it. We must continue to improve it.
So is Alaska's system the blueprint? If we were to replicate Alaska's system to 49 other states, would we basically have this thing solved?
I would go one further and say if we can replicate the Alaska system in just six more states by 2026, which is the roadmap that United America, the organization I run, is focused on, we can have a profound impact in Congress. Because what that will effectively do is liberate two more senators from each of those states. So you get another dozen U.S. senators, more than 10% of the body, dozens of more U.S. representatives who are liberated from the primary problem to serve the majority. And what we've seen in Congress is the difference that just a small group of senators in particular can make by finding common ground on an issue and bringing their colleagues along with that compromise to build the political muscle, to build the political cover, and to actually be an engine for, you've heard of the Gang of Six, the Gang of Eight, the Gang of Ten that have done pretty significant legislation in the past. That can be what our Congress can return to if we're successful in just a handful of more states. And this is not about trying to find the sort of squishy center on public policy issues. This is about principled Democrats, Republicans, hopefully independents coming to the table and being pragmatic to realize that the point of our politics is to narrow our differences to solve common problems. The dysfunction in today's politics is that our system is doing the exact opposite. It is magnifying our differences in order for leaders to score political points. We can change that tide to the extent that more states follow Alaska's lead.
I had on Atlantic writer and award-winning journalist Amanda Ripley on some time ago. She has this book called High Conflict, which talks about conflict resolution. She traveled the world to see how different countries and different states within America were dealing with political conflict and how they resolved it. And there was one phrase that she coined that really has stuck with me. It's called the understory. Behind every story, be it political or otherwise, there's the surface, what something is supposedly about, and then there's the understory, what is in fact the deeper root or the deeper cause of what's happening. And I'd love to just rewind in time and explore what is the understory for you for how you initially came to be passionate about this issue. Because you talk about how in college you led a student advocacy nonprofit called the Can Kicks Back, which is such a great name as someone who is fond of wordplay. You and your colleagues were sick of Washington, quote, kicking the can down the road on our country's long-term fiscal health, our national debt, and the future of, quote, critical programs like Medicare and Social Security, end quote. But I'm just wondering, Nick, is there an earlier inciting incident from your childhood? I always just love learning what was the psychological, emotional, ideological inciting incident for that person to become involved with what they're doing, to become passionate about their life's cause. So was there something before the Can Kicks Back that made you want to focus on a topic like this as your life's work?
It's a great question. I think the early inciting incident was a classmate of mine in my junior year of high school got sick and could not go to a summer program called Boys State. And so the guidance department said I was the backup. And so I got to go. And the American Legion runs the civics program. And for a week, you get to basically play government. You organize in city council, then a state government. And meanwhile, you're getting interesting lessons on civics and politics. And they choose two students from every state to then go and spend a week in Washington for a program called Boys Nation, which I was fortunate to get to do. And it was there I met one of the counselors of this program who was involved with a group called Unity 08, which was organizing a sort of political reform campaign in the 2008 elections. When I graduated high school, I wound up interning for that group, and its founder became my mentor, Doug Bailey, who I dedicate the book to. And it was that experience and Doug's mentorship that opened my eyes to the idea that politics was really about public service, not just about one team winning against the other, and that the growing partisanship and polarization was a threat to our country. And we needed to think outside the box about how to solve it. The 08's idea was to run a bipartisan ticket for president and vice president. And I would say that experience is what led me to think about running for office as an independent. And that's, of course, what put me on this whole journey to figure out our election reform. So, Keith, if you're out there, I'm sorry that you got sick, but that really changed my life.
I love that. It's rare. I was just talking about this with a friend. It is rare that you can look at a single moment in your life as an inflection point. Oftentimes, the ways that we get to the places we end up are the result of so many little micro decisions and micro events that it can be hard to trace what that initial event was. But every once in a while, when a high school colleague gets sick and one door closes and another one opens, it's so wonderful when you can point back at a specific instance like that and say, if that hadn't happened, where might I have gone?
I have no idea. But I feel very lucky and privileged to have found this path because I so deeply believe that the work that we are fortunate to help fund and support around the country in election reform is the challenge of our time. There are many issues that matter. Our democracy is upstream from virtually all of them. And the way that we elect our leaders is upstream of that. And so I can't imagine having a bigger lever than the one that we do right now working on this issue to make a change.
In the closing of the book, you say, quote, ours is a time of choosing. Will we choose to love our democracy more than we choose to hate roughly half of those with whom we share it? If so, we cannot tolerate partisan primaries that disenfranchise voters, fuel division, and disincentivize problem solving. It's that simple. So beyond buying your book, which I highly recommend, and checking out Unite America, which I also recommend, what can the average person who is dissatisfied with our current system, what can they do meaningfully to change things?
Unless you live in Alaska, there is something that anyone can do living in any other state to improve your election system. And I'm sure even Alaska's can be tweaked and improved in some way. So that's the beauty of this movement. It is a state-by-state effort. And so if you're in Pennsylvania, where I'm from, you have political gerrymandering, you have closed partisan primaries, contact your elected official. Let them know that this is not just an issue that you care about, but as an issue that you're going to be voting on. And it doesn't take much. A couple dozen people in a state house or a state senate district could have a profound impact on your elected official who probably isn't even thinking about this issue, right? Because when they're running for office, they're being asked about hot button topics on the left and the right. If we can organize at the grassroots level, people who say, actually, the fundamental issue that we all agree on across lines of difference is that our vote should matter, and that our leaders should represent us, there's something really powerful about that that I think can spark a change. And we've seen that happen already in many states that have made these changes. So regardless of where you live, there's something you can do to improve your election system. And there are groups like Represent Us and Fair Vote and Open Primaries and Rank the Vote. You can find these on our website at uniteamerica.org to connect to you and get involved locally.
The job of reforming our politics in a nonpartisan way that aims to work for all of us is often thankless, grueling work. As we've discussed today, our system incentivizes division and extremism. So the wind is in your face, Nick, and yet you march forward. I sincerely appreciate the work you're doing for all of us, and I am rooting for you.
Thank you so much, Michael. And to end on an optimistic note, having been working on these issues for a decade, I feel we have more wind in our sails than we ever have. And that is unfortunately a function of how much the current system is deteriorating. But fortunately, the silver lining is it's waking more people up that this is the issue we should be focused on. And so we have more momentum, more opportunity to make a difference in 2024 than ever before. And I have confidence that we can do it.
Well, that is good news indeed. Thank you, Nick.
Thank you.
Hey there. If you're hearing this, you're exactly the person this message is for. If you're a fan of the show, please consider giving it a 5-star rating on Apple Podcasts or Spotify, or sharing one of your favorite episodes with a friend or family member, or a coworker, or that barista down the street who always knows your drink order, because those two small actions have outsized impact and will help the show increase its listenership, expand its reach, and continue to attract engaging guests to talk about fascinating topics. But it needs to be said, you just being a listener is already a big deal. So thank you.